How does one know if they are a prophet? How does one know if they are a prophet or not? If you read the Egon from a Baha'i point of view, if you read the Egon, you'll see that you should be heavily persecuted and other similar things. And also from a Baha'i point of view, Baha'u'llah has made it simple to know whether we're prophets or not because he said another one won't come for 1,000 years. So in case you're having feelings of prophethood, you should probably, re-examine them. Do you think it is more effective to live in the UK and earn and contribute to or pioneer somewhere else? Which I don't know the next word. Less materialistic, that's what it is. And teach more effectively there. That's a question I think you can only answer yourself. Everyone's individual circumstances are so different. And Shoghi Effendi used to encourage the people to do what they were inspired to do. But when they asked him, should I continue with university or should I go pioneering? He would oftentimes say that this is your decision to make. Sometimes he would take the person and say, because you know Swedish, because of your family, he would think it very meritorious if you could go to Sweden at this time and later go on with your studies. There's factors in the individual lives which would tell us that. Surely UK, you need to be teaching the cause, you need. But I think that the pioneering, a woman wrote Baha'u'llah once from Iran, asking about pioneering. And he wrote a lovely tablet. It's not translated and published. I think there are, obviously, that I know anything about it, there's some kind of a provisional translation. But he says, be ye a pioneer to the realm of love. That this is the essential movement that God requires of us. If you can add to it physical movement as well out in the world, that's highly meritorious. But the essential one is to pioneer to the realm of love. And I think this coincides with this idea of Baha'u'llah saying that he wants us to read his writings, to see with his eye and hear with his ear. And that if we all make that the goal, I think we'll find we can be effective wherever we are. What did you know about Nicaragua before you went there without Wikipedia and Google? Not much. The committee had sent me, the Pioneer Committee in the United States has sent me an address. They said, when you get to Managua, give this to the taxi driver. I didn't know any Spanish, but I did manage to translate this little card, and it said, from the little tree, 200 meters to the lake. And I didn't know anybody or couldn't speak the language. Well, I got in the taxi and I gave this thing to the taxi driver. He said, muy bien. And he drove off very quickly. So he seemed to know where it was. And he put me off on a street corner 200 meters below what was the arbolito, the little tree, which actually was the biggest tree in the city. It was a crossroads between north and south in the city, a huge thing. And there I was standing on there. I tried to speak English to somebody, they didn't understand anything. And the next thing, somebody else came along, and I tried to ask them if they knew any Americanos. Gringos, sí. Yeah. They pointed to a house, and that was the house of the pioneers, and I managed to get there. But I didn't know, really. How do you do without Wikipedia? You know, I don't know. Both Baha'u'llah and Abdul Baha, there's different circumstances, say that when they need to know something, they see it on a screen before their eyes. Quite interesting, you know, Baha'u'llah can quote past scriptures and so on. Abdul Baha says when he needs to know anything, he also sees it. He says that power is available to us. It's a ray of the universal mind, Abdul Baha says, that can be cast into the heart of the righteous. Okay, now righteous, you have to figure that out to see if you can get a hold of this universal power. But in the meanwhile, you've got your laptop and...
How do we analyze the world without focusing on its negative aspects? Probably you can't, as far as I can tell. You have to be aware of the negative aspects. Shoghi Effendi says we should study the forces of darkness. Be aware of them. He lists about 30 of them in his writings. Everything from atheism and communism and all kinds of things. That's something we need to do. When we say we're not political, it doesn't mean we're uninformed. We should be highly informed. Shoghi Effendi read 4 newspapers a day. He took out the editorials and checked, watched everything. And we need to, you know, we don't enter into partisan politics, but we should be very aware of what's going on in the world around us. And at the same time, reading enough of the divine text so that you can make sense of it. I think that that's an important interaction. If you haven't read The Promised Day Has Come, it's a very important book to read through, Message of Shoghi Effendi, and also the Unfoldment of World Civilization in the World Order Letters, another one. He reviews so much of this, but he puts it in the right framework it's inspirational. He said we should take hope from the deterioration of the world around us. If we can see it in the right way, it's encouraging to us. And then we can release other people from the fear of it if they realize that there's a goal that it's moving towards. It's doing, it's birth pains, taking us to the unity of mankind. Well, as far as I know, you know people that have a negative influence on you. Abdu'l-Bahá suggests twice trying to give the message to somebody. And if they don't respond, then if you're not going to change them, they may change you, you know? And if you're not up to the arguments of somebody that's atheistic and ungodly, then better to move away from it. I think that's important. Many of the atheists are very intellectual in their approach, and if you don't know the teachings very well, you don't know quite how to counter it. I think that worth very carefully considering Baha'u'llah's advice. Sometimes the ungodly is your brother-in-law. That's a problem. Abdu'l-Bahá doesn't say go around and give pamphlets out. He says breathe life into the souls of your fellow men. That's the call of the divine plan. Quite. And then he also says, how can the poor give to the poor? So you have to think about how to get this breath of life in you if you don't feel like you've got enough of it. By the way, he says, besides the core activities, I mean, you want to live the life in the core activities. That's the whole point of those, too. And separate those. How should we use the media to teach the faith? I should write to your NSA, I think, for that one. I don't know. I can't give any specific advice about that. I think it's very important to use the media. And the media now being especially the whole arena of social interaction on the net. We should be seeing how we can develop things there. What if your girlfriend is an atheist and a strong one? Pray, meditate, study, and act. What is the purpose of the physical actions of the long obligatory prayer? Some people think it's to prepare you for yoga exercises. You know, Shoghi Effendi says that you can't divorce these movements from the prayer. They are essential to the prayer. And in their use, in the long run, in their use, I think you'll discover the wisdom of it. It also keeps you somewhat agile, you know. And it prompts memorization. It's very hard to read that verse with your head on the floor and the book under your nose. So that encourages us. But no, in a serious way, he says that this has a very special meaning, and we've got a couple dispensations of physical movements, and it's important to try to come to grips with it. And that's another thing where our inherited way of looking at things keeps us from embracing it perhaps in the fullest way, because it seems strange to our relatives and other people around us. What are the spiritual implications of mental and psychological disorders, schizophrenia, on the soul? Do they impair one's spiritual progress? I think that we're forgiven physical illnesses and mental illnesses of this sort. We know the soul is free of them. This is something that's added to it, and the soul will be free of them eventually. I hope that the Baha'i therapies of healing in the future will lead to a relief of that. Certainly when society isn't quite as agitated as it is now, we may have a better chance of healing mental illnesses. Sometimes it's a physical deficiency, as you know. There are various therapies that treat mental illness with chemical substances and stuff to change it. Not my field, but I think that we have some hope for the future. How do we meditate? I guess that's asking me how I meditate, because I don't know how you meditate. That would be a whole evening's activity if we all told how we meditate. I think I feel like I don't meditate enough. But certainly the faith is different from the older schools of some of the religions, in that meditation is clearing the mind, emptying the mind, going back to nothingness, so to speak. We don't have that. Every word that's related to meditation in the original writings is meditate, ponder, consider, over and over. It always relates to a verse or a specific term or some concept that the manifestation has introduced. So it's meditating on the teachings of the faith, I think, is the secret of that. Shoghi Effendi says we should be careful that we don't repeat the prayers in a rote manner. That when we pray, particularly the obligatory prayer, and particularly if your prayers are reduced to the noon prayer, you want to think about the meaning of it each time. Otherwise it becomes routine, he said, and then you don't get the benefit from it. You fulfill the obligation, but you may not get the greater benefit that you would have if you weigh it in yourself. In the whole, the middle of that prayer, where it's, you know, my powerlessness and thy might. As we approach in our understanding in the study of the faith, the might and the riches of God, it reveals to us our own powerlessness and our poverty. So there's all kinds of things to think about in that. What are the Baha'i views on the evolution of man? That's a kind of a big subject. If you're a Baha'i, you go to some answered questions and read those chapters again. You could think about it. But what we say is that man has always been man, though he's may have passed through different forms, but that the existence of man, that is the instrument of human consciousness on a planet, Abdu'l-Bahá likens to the head in a body. If there's a planet without a human, or without a rational component, it would be like God producing a body without a head. What would be the point of it? This also, the implications of that is that the universe is teeming with rational beings of all sorts, and that in the process of unification, we will come in contact with them eventually. I dare say not you and me, but future generations. Baha'u'llah, you know, has said that every fixed star hath its planets, and every planet its creatures. They asked the master about it, and he said that means creatures with will, that means to some degree animals and rational souls. But he says that the beings on those worlds are created in conformity with the chemical constitutions of those realms. So it may not be just identical. I think form is not, form is something spiritual, you know. It expresses itself in matter, but there's going to be have to be some way of association between us. Mr. Olinga told me, he said he was in the presence of the guardian and in Haifa, the hand of the Qazi Nukolingi. He wasn't the hand of the Qazi then, he was the knight of Baha'u'llah for Cameroon, and he'd gone to the Holy Land, and he had a most extraordinary pilgrimage with Shoghi Effendi. He said one morning, Shoghi Effendi said to him that Abdu'l-Bahá called this planet, this world, the hell of the planets, the most backward of them all. And then he's Mr. Olinga was set back a little by that, and then the guardian said, they still make war. I mean, you want a scale of how backward we are, it's that the people on this planet still plot to murder each other in mass ways and take land from each other, and completely ignoring the fact that we're a human race that have been provided by a creator with a wonderful world to live in that we should be sharing with each other and preparing ourselves spiritually for the next stage of existence, which is much more important than this one. But we haven't quite got that straight yet. The hell of the planets. And then he said, then Shoghi Effendi added, he said, the tail of the dog. Now, progressive revelation, the nature of revelation, we're told we have a revelation which corresponds to our times and to our needs. And that it's, what does he call it? Came back. Sorry about that. Religious truth is relative and not absolute. So the revelation that we're given, this is the day of God. It's the day of God for this planet, that's for sure. And it's the most great revelation that's ever come. So if indeed this negative, we're hearing this as hearsay, as pilgrim notes, but if it is indeed that backward, I think we're convinced by the fact that we still murder each other. Still, it's the day of God, and it's perfect for us where we are. It's relative to our needs and requirements as human beings, both individually and collectively. So that should move us forward and give us hope again. How do we find the true religion objectively? I'm not sure what direction that question is going, but whoever made the question could ask some of the other Baha'is around them and see what they might make of it. Religion objectively. The true religion objectively, I think this goes back to the Igon again, the mysteries and the truths that the Igon reveals is the way to be able to judge religion. That's the best I can do with that one. Oh, that's very good. This is a fourfold question. The third part of it is, who am I? What is the purpose of life? Why do we exist? Who am I? How can I find myself? Very good. They're all very important questions. I would have hoped that in the course of the talk some of those might have been touched on a bit, but purpose of life, we're told in the verses of the Revelation, is to know and to worship God, to know and love God. And we're told that the knowledge of God is in no wise possible except through the knowledge of the manifestation of God. So then we look into the lives of the manifestations and we understand and see the inspiration that they have received from God. We exist as a preparatory stage in this world. The Baha'i writings say that this is like the embryo for the next world. In the womb of the mother, we were developing those physical characteristics and senses that we would need in order to exist happily here. And we're told that here we're supposed to be evolving those spiritual virtues and vision that we need in order to experience the fullness of the next world. So that would be the purpose of life from a Baha'i point of view. And who am I? You are a precious entity in the eyes of God. But you may not have reached your full potential yet. I hope you will. How can I find myself? In New England, there was a young man present while Abdu'l-Bahá was talking about the purpose of religion and so on. And after the comments of the masters, one of the friends who was there asked him what he thought. Because the question is, are you going to recognize religion? He said, the young man said, no, he said, you know, I want to find myself. And they translated that for Abdu'l-Bahá. And Abdu'l-Bahá lovingly turned to the young man and he said, without light, nothing is seen. And I oftentimes think that's quite a lucid commentary on modern-day psychology and psychiatry. Because we're trying to solve the people's problems with outside the light of the revelation. The light of the revelation makes a human being into a human being. Before that, it's an animal. Pretty not a very pleasant animal, for the most part. Has to be changed. So I think, how can I find myself? You turn to the light, and that will illumine something latent and very wonderful and unique within you. Do you think that disability rights should be championed by Baha'is in the same way as racial gender equality has been? I don't know what my opinion would mean in that sense. I really haven't formed an opinion about comparison between those two things. I would think this would be something that you would either arrive at on your own or you could ask the House of Justice where we would position ourselves in such a thing, but certainly we should be in favor of all the essential rights of other human beings. Should Baha'is support an overthrow of a regime? The Arab Spring, it says here. Sure, go ahead if you want, but you know, I'm happy that the people think they've done something, but I think that they don't realize what they've done yet. That doesn't mean I liked what was there before, but I wouldn't put a lot of hopes in regime changes in the Middle East. There's a habit and pattern of life that's there, and mostly one has the impression that forces have led to this that will now take advantage of it. Because most of the young enthusiasm of being free or having liberty or freedom or all the whatever it is, it doesn't have much of a vision of what it wants. Maybe it's MTV, maybe, I don't know what what they have in mind, but whether they'll be able to follow through with that, we hope so. Whether they will then allow the faith to be taught openly, that we hope so. I think there's something about freedom can be measured by how much liberty the Baha'is have to share their religion with others. Could you please say a few words about the persecution of the Baha'is in Iran? Yes. Well, I think, you know, Baha'u'llah is all-powerful. And I don't believe that what's happening to the Baha'is of Iran is just happenstance. It's all in the hands of Baha'u'llah. It's the revolution has done amazing things for the Baha'i community, and it's sobered up all the rest of us in the world too. I mean, when you think as a Baha'i, you're reading about the Baha'is being killed. Baha'is that were asked if they would recant their faith, they won't be killed, and they say, no, I'll stand for the faith, and they're killed. And then you think, what about me now, you know, living in the West, and is this going to come to me? And what if it comes to me? How will I react? Very good question for everybody. I mean, this is very sobering in the Baha'i world. We had people writing, will you please stop sending these messages about all these bloody massacres? It's spoiling our feasts. Sorry about that, you know. None of your communities. The other thing the Yaron, none of them have ever written and said that, please, please pray for us to be released. None of the prisoners have ever asked the house that. They've always said, pray for us that we can be steadfast and hold up the honor of the cause. There's something very significant, friends. This period of these 3 years, you see it as a transition, particularly with the expat Persian community around the world, of a whole change of attitude, of a whole realization that we have all been lied to about what the Baha'is are and who the Baha'is are, that any of us that know Baha'is know how wonderful they are, and they're not what the people are saying, what the government has been saying. And so in a sense, there's a kind of a liberation of attitude. It's no longer forbidden to say the B word. It comes out in the media even. But there was a period, you know, where no one, they just refer to it indirectly. It was like it was a social taboo to say Baha'i. And now that's lifted. And there's programs, and programs outside the country are going in. And you remember this statement last year of it's more than a year now, of the Persian professionals, academicians, and professors, and everything, saying that they were ashamed of the treatment that had been meted out to the Baha'is in the history of the faith. So there's things that are changing. It's not a static condition. And when Baha'u'llah is ready, that situation will be liberated, I feel sure.
This is kind of related.
What a creative audience. There's more and more coming here. This is kind of related. I'm teaching some practicing Muslim friends in a weekly study class, leading on the Kitab-e-Iqan and answering their questions, something that they have been honest in, that they're learning about the faith to teach their own faith better and challenge the Baha'i faith. Should I be cautious about this, or should I carry on unrestrained as the wind? I don't know you well enough to answer that question. But I think you'd want to be cautious to be sure that they're not going to attack you anyway. But if you have a knowledge of the Iqan in its original, and you can bring points to them. How many of the Baha'is in the world came to the cause through trying to oppose it, through consciously trying to oppose it? So if they're at least looking at the faith in order to counter it, that's a good step towards coming to the cause. Usually people in that position lose out and embrace the faith. In the West, it's funny, we could win all the arguments in the West, and the person just says, walks away. But in the East, there's still this kind of honor that if you're defeated in debate or in discussion, then you should submit. It's a fundamental difference between East and West attitudes. Maybe it's deteriorating in the East now, and it's not so much that way. But all the original, you know, in reading the history of the faith, with Dornbergers and other episodes in Iran, you see that these outstanding teachers, they could bring every proof until the person couldn't answer it, and they would accept. Or they wouldn't, I don't know. But I think in the most part, we hear the stories about the ones that did.
not a core activity.
Yes, what's your view regarding firesides, although it's not a core activity?
I think that Shoghi Effendi has said that teaching the faith in your home is one of the best ways to teach people. And maybe the word fireside has been superseded to some degree, but every place that I'm traveling, the devotional meetings are really the same as the old firesides. People don't smoke as much in them as they used to. I had to smoke to become a Baha'i because the fireside was so full of smoke in California that I couldn't breathe and my eyes would hurt so bad. So if I smoked, then I felt better. I could. Some things are changing, you know, it's good. I think that, you know, the teaching of friends in your home, a devotional meeting or whatever other reason you have, that's part of individual teaching. If you want to call it a fireside, the fireside is just the model of the fireside where you had a public meeting where people came off the street and came in and listened and went away again and you didn't know what was going on, has not proven very effective. But the home meetings and discussions after devotional, almost always after the devotional meetings, people are asking questions about it. Now, you could be very strict, but I think the House of Justice warned us about being too fanatic and strict about these things and say, no, this is a devotional, we can't answer your questions, you know. We're praying all week that they'll ask questions and then we don't want to answer them, I don't know. Oh my. What wisdoms would you pass on to your spiritual sons and daughters in choosing a partner for marriage? Be cautious. There's one clue. It's a difficult one, but if you can absorb it and you can match those circumstances, you're going to be better off. And that is Abdu'l-Bahá saying that in marriage, if one partner loves the other partner more than they love God, it will be the cause of holding and hindering both of their progress. That means that your partner that you choose should love God and love the cause more than they love you. That's a kind of a safe starting point. And my wife and I put that up early on and talked about it, and then we said, okay, we don't ever discuss the word divorce. We don't bring that. You can argue, but we don't say, okay, well, let's get a divorce. It's too facile. You know, once you're in it, you do your best to stay in it. And there's a terrific confirmation, I think, to marriages that proceed like that. And if you put the cause first in your decision-making as a couple, then you find things move in a very different way from not. I remember we were always busy on weekends, so I'd say, okay, honey, next weekend we're going to stay home and just relax and enjoy each other. Then we'd fight like cats and dogs. So I'd say, okay, honey, we won't do that again. That was when we were in South America. You know, we had, well, there were things to do every weekend. What could you do? We had a lot of time together, but we didn't have the weekends always. She was the secretary of the NSA, and I was a counselor running around. So, what experience deranged your life most significantly? Oh, changed your life most significantly. What is the most precious memory serving as a member of the Universal House of Justice? What is your happiest memory and your saddest memory from your time at the World Center? Then they put in parentheses that you can share. How is life after the Baha'i World Center? That's a bit like living in exile. I mean, 37 years that we were there, it's a long time. It doesn't quite go away, you know. And carrying the weight of the cause is such a relief. At first, people would say, well, do you miss the Holy Land? And I would say, no. And then I'd see them look shocked. So I said, oh, that's not going to work. So I thought it through, and I said, oh, we miss the shrines, and we miss the friends, and we miss. But really, friends, the
missing the weight of the administrative weight of the House of Justice. I don't miss it. I'm relieved. And if anybody wants to be a member of the House of Justice, the punishment should be to be a House member for a little while. No, you don't hear the House of Justice asking you to pray for the House of Justice, but you should pray for the members' friends. The members are human beings, and they have to face all these difficulties. The House of Justice doesn't need prayers. It's an it. Even when we were there, we realized, you know, the House is an it. It's not us. We don't write we this, we that, you know. The House of Justice states in its letters, the House of Justice sends you regards, or the House of Justice, it's always that abstract. And that thing is there, whoever the members are. It will remain there. But the individual members, some of them have labored under very difficult physical conditions, and the challenges of your offspring in such a situation. The wives have suffered terrific difficulty. It's not an easy, let us say it's not an enviable position. I've heard Ian say it's the mercy of God that women are exempt. What? You know, militant women, they want to be on it, but I don't think if you were on it, you would be want to be on it anymore. What can I tell you? That's my experience. What experience changed your life most significantly? Becoming a Baha'i. And that wasn't easy. They gave you tests in those days, you know. It was an interview of the local assembly, and I remember they interviewed me, and then they said, there's no privacy here. Would you mind standing in the street while we discuss this? And it was cold, and I went in the street, and 40 minutes later, they called me back. I thought, they'll never decide. I'm never going to be a Baha'i. Maybe I can try another community. When they brought me back in, they said, so sorry, but the assembly hadn't met in some months, and we had a little business to do, and wanted to have the closing prayer with you. Okay, thank you very much. I found out that community, most of the people went pioneering. I did. And it was pretty evident why it was a good idea. I remember a new House member, they said, okay, there's folders of the incoming mail on these desks on the second floor. You go and you read each letter and you initial it and so on. The first letter I looked at was a short little letter from a youth in the West. It said, hi, guys. There are great moments in Haifa as a House member. The House has to be able to do its work in a collegial way, and it's friendly and easy with the members, and there's a lot of humor that goes on too. It's impossible to manage any other way. But when anybody comes in the chamber or the presence of the House, or when the House goes out to meet the pilgrims, another atmosphere surrounds us. It's kind of an amazing thing. And one of the great events was when we walked out on the platform in Haifa, being on camera for the World Congress in New York. That was quite an event. You felt the Baha'is there all in Newark. Everybody stood up, and we were seeing some screens of that at the same time that we were there, and we had a spokesman, Dr. Roo, who delivered the message to the Congress. How many of you were in that Congress? Some of you. Still, yeah. I don't know. The House of Justice will call another Congress at 2021. We'll see. What are your views on door-to-door teaching, especially in conservative suburban areas? Well, that's a setup question. What can I say about that? Here, you keep that, okay? I think that it depends on who's doing it and what the circumstances are. I haven't done too much door-to-door teaching. I've done village-to-village teaching, where you call, the whole village came out to see you, and you'd sit and talk with them. So, and I've been in places where there were no doors on the houses, so that's another, gives you another setting. So when the House of Justice refers to this question, it's, you have to use your good sense also, what is effective, what works. I know I've, you know, like all of these things, you'll get some reports that say, I was shy, I didn't want to do this, I lived in a section with mansions, but I prayed the Kaaba of Ahmad, and I went to my neighbor and began to, and they were so happy to hear about the faith, and she says, you know, the next neighbor over there is also interested in spiritual matters. So you get, but the other ones say, you know, okay, they slammed the door in my face, or they said they had no time for it, or whatever. Friends, it's lovely to meet with you, and thank you so much for coming out, giving me a chance to see you all, and thank you for the organizers for inviting me, and we hope we'll see you again one of these times, and in the meanwhile, I hope you will be very successful in your spiritual efforts to deepen individually in the writings of the faith. Thank you.